This afternoon, April the 20th, 2011, we have a distinguished guest with us, Jay Harris. He's the law clerk for the Crow Tribe. Legislature law clerk, I guess, excuse me. And then we're going to have Patrick Hill and Alati Alish. That's his Crow name. And this afternoon, we'd like to ask Jay Harris to talk about himself a little bit before we go on into the discussion.
Okay, well, thank you. First of all, I would like to begin by saying that it is quite an honor and a privilege to be here for a good, candid discussion with Pat Hill and others here in the recording studio. My name is Awakawe Agen Chawagish. That means praise on top of the mountain. That was a name given to me by Newton Old Crow Sr. It's a name I'm very proud of and one that I daily hope and strive to live up to. As far as my background goes, by way of introduction, as you mentioned, I currently am employed with the Crow Tribal Legislative Branch of Government as a law clerk, so I work in the legal office. I do a lot of in-house legal research, so you might consider my job something along the lines of an office solicitor, if you will, 9 to 10 hours a day, doing research on laws and regulations. And that includes, of course, within the past few months, doing lots of research with regards to the Crow-Montana Water Compact and the Crow Water Rights Settlement Act. I'm a graduate of the University of Colorado School of Law, located in Boulder. I've also studied public administration in graduate school at the University of Montana in Missoula. I've got a bachelor's in science and history and political science from Rocky Mountain College in Billings. I'm a proud graduate of Lodgegrass High School, 1999, and I'm an enrolled member of the Crow Tribe. And by virtue of that fact, and am a member of the Crow Tribal General Council, so I try to keep a close eye on what the government's doing, not only in my capacity as an employee of the legislative branch legal office, but also my capacity as a sovereign member of the Crow Nation. So I am a descendant of the Yellowtail family, the Hugs family, and I'm very, very proud of my Crow heritage. While I was in law school, I was gearing towards joining the Air Force. I was actually in the Air Force Reserve Officers Training Corps in Boulder. And one of my law professors, Indian law professor, asked me what I was planning on doing upon graduation. I noted that to him, and he said, well, what's your main interest in serving in the military? So I simply replied, I want to serve my nation. And he said, the best way for you to serve your nation is to go to Crow Agency. So that's where I'm at here today, and hopefully we can have a good discussion about how wise a career choice that was. We find ourselves as a tribe, as a tribal nation, facing a lot of difficult issues, a lot of difficult choices that have to be made. One that we made recently on March 19th, I don't know if people completely understood just how difficult, but in terms of the decision, it's been made, so we move forward the best we can. And I know that was the intended topic of discussion tonight, was the Crow Water Rights Settlement Act, so I'd like to engage in that discussion with Pat. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you very much, Jay. I admire anybody, whoever they are, that take a deep concern and involvement within their heritage, but also in particularly with the Crows carrying out their names, which are given to them. I admire that very highly. I, as a Crow, among those other Crows, are of a six-member group which are identified as Alatis, which are in separate owners of tribal property, but also distinct separate owners of allotted land. Brought about by that of legislation to the present date, and in so much as our rights, with the Water Compact, with the settlement, there are many Crows who feel obligations not only by the federal government but by the tribe weren't fully met. It's a confusing issue. It's something that I sit in puzzlement and amazement as I began to find out things in regard to the settlement and things in regard to the compact. If anything, the primary concern is that of the jurisdiction. Jurisdiction meaning as to what rights do we have, but what rights were given up, if waived or if retained at all. There are many crows that were told that we have rights to that of the Treaty of 1868 in so much as a priority date. And yet we, in confusion in that, have also been led to that the non-Indian also has those same rights of the Port Laramie Treaty of 1868. Also, there's the Dawes Act that pertains in particular within its writings to rights of the allottee as to the allocation of that of water through the chain of command to the Secretary of Interior. There are many, many things that are literal confusion that needed to be interpreted, I feel, before that of March 19th of this year. There are many levels to address here, but we've had attorneys who have come in from New Mexico. They've discussed it with tribal people here and in Billings, and there are those concerns that still we wonder about. And I would first begin by just what does this really mean in so much as the future of the Crows, the future of the people who have prepared their land, kept their land for their children, for their grandchildren. What, if any, will they still retain that to pass on as it was passed on to us? Maybe you could start somewhere there, Jay.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot to ponder. The comments you've made, Pat, are largely a commentary of promises made and promises broken, and that's the recurrent theme throughout Indian law in the history of federal mistreatment of Indian nations. It is a strong theme in the Crow history as well. Perhaps Dr. Martin Luther King said it best using the analogy of bounced checks when it came to the United States Constitutional Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, with the minorities in the United States, that there was promises made, and he used the analogy of a check being written and the return of insufficient funds message coming back throughout the course of American history, of course, prompting the civil rights movement. And similarly, with the Crow tribal history that we've been able to review as tribal members and as legal researchers, we see a strong similar theme. Now, I guess as far as the federal government goes, through self-admission, if you will, one of the strongest pronouncements of this history of mismanagement is probably from 1973, and that was the Federal Water Commission, which was charged with giving a report to the President of the United States and Congress on the plan of action for water in the United States, particularly water in the West, and particularly all of the Indian water claims throughout the Western United States. And basically, the National Water Commission said that in the history of the mismanagement of Indian resources, that the federal government's neglect of protecting Indian water rights is reserved for one of its quote-unquote sorriest chapters. And from 1973 to the present time, we haven't seen much in the way of real substantive or significant improvement from that point. And opportunity after opportunity are presented to the federal government to make good on their promise that goes back, in our case, to 1868 and even previous. And that comes in the form of water settlement acts. And time and again, we see the shortcomings, we see the shortcuts, and we see the non-performance of a true trusteeship. And that's really the case here today, although I would note, Pat, it's probably premature to say that this Crow-Montana Water Compact is in effect an extraordinary takings of a Lati's water, because we simply don't know exactly what the quantified water right is going to be for a Lati's. The so-called Appendix 1 to the compact has not been finalized. In fact, it has never been presented in draft form for review by the Lati's, and it's questionable as to whether or not it ever will be before it's submitted to the state water court. And originally, if any of the listeners aren't aware, terms of the compact provide that that Appendix 1, which is going to be a proposed decree to the state water court, articulating with specificity all of the tribal water rights, including those of the Lati's, was supposed to be done within 1 year after the state legislature approved the compact back in June of 1999. And here we are in April of 2011. We still do not have an Appendix 1. It was supposed to be jointly submitted by the United States and the tribe, and it's supposed to have gone to the state of Montana for review. They would have 6 months to object to any of the claims stated in Appendix 1, and then after the process of hashing out the objections, then it would go to the Montana Water Court in Bozeman, presumably with all three sovereigns joining together and presenting something that was acceptable to the governments and in the form of a proposal. We don't have that, and until such time as that is going to be made public through its filing, we can only speculate with conjecture, you know, as to what it's going to contain. But the fact that there hasn't been the adherence to that term of the compact, and the fact that you've got multiple testimonies before Congress leading up to the congressional passage last year criticizing the fact that there wasn't significant federal involvement in the development of any appendices to the compact. We got five of them. You got the first that I mentioned, Appendix 1, the most important for purposes of defining the tribal water right, including that of the Lati's. You've got two presidential administrations that have been sort of outspoken to Congress in terms of that particular issue, reserving and withholding support. The fullest expression of federal support obviously is going to be the president. He signed it into law, so now you've got a shift in federal policy across the board where now they're pushing for finalization, and with the hope, I imagine with the hope, that everybody's going to be playing fair and working together. So that's basically where we're at right now in terms of the Lati's water rights. A much better course of action obviously would have been for Congress to provide a live appropriation of the entire $460 million, irrespective of whether or not it's tied to approval of the compact, hold that in trust, pending when the tribe and the state of Montana eventually have a compact approved, give it to the Secretary of the Interior to sign on behalf of the federal government. And that's the congressional involvement. The money's there. People don't have to worry about voting yes in order to receive the money. It's not held hostage. Congress appropriates it, and then the secretary will sign off on a compact that's eventually hashed out and agreed to between the state and the tribe. Right now, my understanding is there's probably, with the large concerns that some of the centers have, it probably boils down to probably half a dozen issues. Most people that I'm familiar with as far as speaking to these issues are pretty fair-minded, pretty objective when it comes to a sense of fairness, that there is going to be a little bit of give and there's going to be a little bit of take. That's in a compact between governments. That's the nature of a compromise document. And when it comes to those low water years in the future, a shortage sharing agreement has to be a major aspect of the compact, and that's going to mean that we're not going to be able to utilize seniority to call the water to ensure that every tribal water user is satisfied fully before the state-based water users receive any water. There's compromise that has to be given there. We've agreed in our compact not to regulate state-based water users. We've got every bit the concern that the state has in terms of us regulating them and them regulating us, if you will. That's a bit of a compromise. There's these various areas that are of concern to people, but if they were hashed out with more definition, both Montana and the Crow tribe, you get reasonable negotiations as the result of reasonable discussions. And I don't know that there has been reasonable discussion throughout the course of the time when the Crow tribe first approached Governor Roscoe in the late 90s with a proposal for a water compact. The record shows us that that was in late 1998, and just a few months later, you already had a compact that was essentially hashed out and finalized, ready for a presentation to the state legislature. That took place in a June 22nd special session. No significant involvement by the Crow Tribal General Council legislature of its day, at least not that the record would reflect. And then fast forward now a little over a decade, and other than these so-called public meetings, more akin to propaganda and salesmanship by Akin Gump, to the public, you have had now very little, if any, significant involvement from the Crow Tribal General Council. Again, the sovereign body and sovereign voice of the Crow Tribe. And that's reflective of a democracy that's not fully functional. You haven't had the kind of public discussion, deliberation, or discourse that's needed on the tribal side. That's unfortunate, but you see now where people voted and are now asking questions, trying to find answers to questions that should have been long discussed, long understood, and long hashed out to hammer out something that we would, as a tribe, truly support. Even 7228 is not the kind of mandate you would hope for an issue of this magnitude. And I find it somewhat irresponsible personally if I could say this, that I don't know, can you speak in terms of political dissent on the air? I'm just teasing. This is America, right? We have First Amendment. That the Crow Tribal Administration, the executive branch, wanting to have a parade and a dinner following the parade to celebrate passage of the Crow Water Rights Settlement Act by the Crow Tribe. Personally, I think that was a little bit disrespectful of 28% of those who came out and voted, approximately 1,000 Crows.
Against.
Right. So there are certain things that when it happens, it's clearly in the tribe's best interest to celebrate, bring out the drums, get the parade going, let's cook some meat, you know. We win before the U.S. Supreme Court, or we win something of such importance and clear benefit to the tribe as a whole, that's cause for celebration. But when you have a significant number of Crows, 1,000, that's times 10 of the quorum that was needed in the old days, pre-2001, to establish a tribal council meeting. You only needed 100. So you got 1,000 Crows, nearly, that said no to this compact in light of 460 million, in light of all of the pressure coming from the executive branch. That's a pretty bold statement. It's only 28%, but it's 1,000 Crows. And that's something that should have been respected. And in fact, I think a more responsible tribal leadership would have done their best to cultivate support from those dissenters to try to respond to their concerns, to try to mitigate what concerns they may have had, or to try to address those concerns. And that's the kind of collaboration that just has been missing throughout this process.
I totally agree in so much as that it's almost like going before that of a janitor and saying, I like it, and yet also going before the President of the United States and he likes it tremendously. There's a world of difference there, in so much as the approach that was taken from the federal administration to that of the state to that of the tribe. And yet there are those who can win and lose and lose and win and win and win, but there are those who like it much better when they lose. And I personally, myself, feel is that that is what inevitably happened to the Crows. We received that of a large sum of dollars, but always within our history, we give up much, much, much more in realization that we accepted so little.
And if I could make comment on that, Pat, I mean, it's pretty confusing when you've got the Akin Gump attorneys telling the media that this $460 million is not tied to water. It is an approximation of the likely damages award the Crow Tribe would have won had it prevailed in a suit against the United States for historic mismanagement of our water resources. And there are ample law professors out there who have written law review articles criticizing the methodology that is often used by the federal government to determine what the settlement contribution amount is when that settlement amount contribution is tied to something that that is considered as a approximation of the legal damages that would be received, because there's no generally accepted methodology that has withstood the rigor of judicial review, because you don't have live lawsuits where you actually have a settlement of a claim against the United States for historic breach of trust. So you're basically taking, in the end, some attorney or federal administrator's word for it that this is what you would likely have won. And the criticism springs from the notion that, well, you get 10 attorneys, you're going to get 10 approximations, and there's nothing that's sound enough to use that as a basis. Now, there's when you talk about giving up things, one thing that I've observed that in this process, and of course, you know, across the country with Indian tribes settling their water claims, is there's a general acceptance out there that as applied to our situation as a tribe, that in 1868, that the federal government reserved water for the Crow tribe implicitly. That, of course, is a reflection of the Winters Doctrine, but people are quick to say Winters, federal reserved rights, and move on. Well, Winters itself, a 1908 Supreme Court decision that arose from the Fort Belknap Reservation in northern Montana, was an important decision that actually is the foundation for modern Indian law in the context of reserved water rights. But that court's decision was somewhat ambiguous as to who was reserving the water. In fact, someone could make a great argument looking at the language in that decision that it was the tribe that had reserved the water. People often don't question who's the reserver of the water, because normally the federal reservation date is sufficient to preempt any state water users. That is, with Fort Belknap specifically, in 1888, a congressional act establishing their, it was a congressional act establishing their reservation, that predated any state water claims. And likewise, with our situation in 1868, using that as a priority date, that would effectively preempt any state-based water claims as well. Now, the law review articles that are out there right now, in fact, one as late as 2010, this was authored by Robert Anderson. He's the director of the Native American Law Center at the University of Washington in Seattle. He seriously questions the general acceptance of the federal reserved water right, basically encouraging tribes to claim that they reserve the water. After all, the Winters decision speaks of the tribe having dominion and control over the land and the water, and you've got ample Supreme Court decisions that follow in that line to speak of treaties being conceptualized as not a delegation of rights to a tribe or anything of that sort, but basically a articulation of what rights the treaty, the tribe was giving up. So the tribe retained everything else. And the implicit understanding, of course, for the Crow tribe in 1868 would have been that it was in the understanding that it was receiving the land and the water associated with what was being established. And that was the Crow homeland, called a reservation by the federal negotiators. So the Crow tribe had an awesome opportunity to make a bold stand that a lot of other tribes, for some reasons or another, have not made, and that is to claim that it's a tribal reserved water right versus a federal reserved water right. In the end, is that consequential? Well, perhaps, but the 1860, and it may not be too late either. We do have now the responsibility for promulgating a tribal water code. We've got 3 years from March 19th to do it, so we've got until 2014. We know our priority date, according to the compact, as well as the Settlement Act, is going to be May 7th, 1868. Of course, that doesn't necessarily translate to enforceability, and that's another issue associated with the compact, the tribal juniors versus tribal seniors. But I personally believe that the Crow chiefs and headsmen who represented the tribe in 1868 with the discussions with the United States and those who signed the treaty understood that they were reserving, the tribe, the tribal leaders, were reserving all the land and all the water for the future benefit and use of the Crow tribe. And that is something that we haven't had our trustee stand and fight for us on. That's something we haven't had our executive branch attorneys stand and fight for us on. And that's something that our tribal leaders haven't stood on and fought for. And it's unfortunate. Eventually some tribe is going to, and they're going to serve as the model for other tribes to follow. We've got some tribes out there that have a priority date of time immemorial, and as recognized even by the federal courts. Look at Klamath in Oregon, for example. The Ninth Circuit established a time immemorial priority date for that tribe based on their treaty rights to hunt and fish, the recognition being that when the treaty was concluded, theirs in 1864, I believe, that Klamath Treaty reserved a right for that tribe to perpetuate and continue its rights to hunt and to fish, and of course, those being water-intensive activities, that there was a recognition that that tribe's right to hunt and fish included the right to have water available to support hunting and fishing, and since there could be no authoritative date established as to when they were first in that portion of Oregon, the courts threw their hands in the air and said, yes, time immemorial. And it would be inconsequential to establish a date because they would be senior of all seniors. So the Crow tribe could have at least argued for something like that. When you make the argument, what's the worst thing that happened? Well, you fall back on 1868. So we didn't make the argument, and that's where we're at, 1868, May 7th, as a priority date. And as far as what the tribe's giving up, it's discouraging when the tribe loses on issues. It's particularly discouraging when we don't even make the argument.
I'd like to ask a couple questions. This is Govinda here. And we fast forward to today, and we look at the allottees in relationship to the tribal representation in context of this water document. What is the percentage of the land base that is actually allottees versus the percentage of the land base that is tribal? What is the involvement of the BIA in representation within the dialogue within the federal mechanisms? And how does that play out in terms of junior water rights and this whole thing with the tribal in memorial? I think that's a very important component.
Well, I won't get the percentages absolutely correct, but combined, the trust land is a majority of the land on the Crow Indian Reservation, meaning essentially that it's over 50%. And of that percentage, a slight majority is going to be individual trust land that is allotted tribal land, land that the Crow tribe held in common that was subsequently allotted under the various allotment acts, principally the 1920 Crow Allotment Act. And, of course, that's the land that's owned in equitable title, beneficial title, by the allottees modernly. And that comprises a larger percentage than the tribal trust lands, lands held in trust by the United States for and on behalf of the Crow tribe. And then, of course, the balance is going to be fee lands, some of which are owned by Crow Indians, some of which even are owned by the Crow tribe. And as far as the status of the fee lands now, very large majority of those are held by non-Indians, of course. Now, the nature of the interplay between the tribe and the United States with regards to allotted lands, as an example, is a fairly complex question that has produced a lot of headache, I know, amongst the federal government. If you look at the Secretary of the Interior, who serves as a trustee for both the tribes and the allottees, he's got two hats to wear, and it's often two hats that he can't wear simultaneously. There is, for anybody's reference, a 1995 Interior Solicitor's opinion. That was John Leschi, who's pretty knowledgeable. This is during the Clinton administration. Leschi wrote an opinion concerning this very issue in the context of the Southern Arizona Water Rights Settlement Act, and there was not enough specificity in that Water Rights Settlement Act concerning the extent of tribal regulatory authority over allottees' water. The main source of federal law, of course, is going to be the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution, because water and land both, as the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized, held by allottees, is a protected property right or interest that the allottees have. In other words, you can't take that land without due process and just compensation. The whole works. It's protected. And not only that, but the General Allotment Act, it's codified today at 25 U.S.C. Section 381, I believe, guarantees to allottees a just and equitable allocation of water, and that's going to spring from the tribal water rights. So that's something that is a substantive basis for allottees to fall back on. In addition to the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, you've also got the 1968 Indian Civil Rights Act, which, for those who don't know, the Crow tribe adopted almost verbatim the language in the 1968 Indian Civil Rights Act in our 2001 Crow Constitution. Very notable to mention that the 1948 Crow Constitution didn't have a Bill of Rights. The 2001 Constitution does. It bars the taking of private property for public use without just compensation and due process. The most authoritative federal position on that issue is that allottees' interests in land and water are to be considered private property for purposes of the Indian Civil Rights Act, which tribal courts have the enforcement authority on. So if you want to argue Fifth Amendment, you're going to want to eventually find yourself in the federal courts. At any rate, the tribes have pretty broad regulatory authority over their members on their reservations, and that's bolstered by inherent tribal sovereignty as recognized by the courts, but also by federal statutes. For example, the American Indian Agricultural Resource Management Act, 1993, purports to give tribes broad regulatory authority over Indian land and water on their reservations. And that's something that hasn't been fully hashed out in terms of water. That was partially considered by John Leshy in his 1995 solicitor's opinion on the issue of the extent to which tribes can regulate allottees. But if you look at the Crow Water Rights Settlement Act, there's ample language that should serve as guidance as to the extent of Crow tribal regulatory authority over allottees' water. It would be notable to mention that any allottee who wants to pursue a challenge to the amount of water that is made available under a tribal permit would have to seek tribal exhaustion as something of a preliminary remedy before going to a federal forum. So that's a nod to tribal sovereignty. It follows along the lines of standard administrative law, where you want to have a first avenue of relief available administratively before going into the judicial arena, and also the fairly long-standing rule of the National Farmers Union decision, which, of course, sprung up out of the Crow Reservation involving our current Justice of the Peace, that tribes, specifically tribal courts, get first crack at determining whether or not they've got jurisdiction over a claim. But clearly, under the Crow Water Rights Settlement Act, the Crow tribe would have jurisdiction at first glance for anything pertaining to regulation or management of the Crow tribal water right, which the allottee's water right is a component of. Perhaps it could be viewed or conceptualized as a pie. That's probably the simplest way to look at it. A pie representing all of the water on the Crow Reservation. Well, how big a pie is it? That's going to be essentially the average amount of water available in any given year. Find someone that knows that, and I'd be fairly impressed. I think the information is out there, but that's information that your average Crow probably can't tell you, because it's information that the average federal bureaucrat associated with this Water Compact or Settlement Act also either won't tell you or can't tell you. Okay, well, that's how big the pie is. We know that there's definitely a finite amount of water on the Crow Reservation. Well, how much does the state-based water users get, and how much do the tribal water users get? How big a slice available to each? Probably the heart of the compact, and probably the most important question in the end. And again, find someone that can tell you an answer as to how big a piece of the pie either side's going to receive. And again, this was a large part of the criticism that was levied at the process by folks such as Chris Pauley in the Bush administration, Assistant Secretary of the Interior for Water and Science, as well as Michael Connor, current Commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation. Both testified before Congress as to those issues, basically telling Congress to slow down. The historic reflection of what would happen in the event that you don't have finalization of these compact terms and documents if the negotiations post-congressional ratification were to break down is that you'd have to resubmit to Congress, and you might not have a finalization as intended. And not only that, but just for the sake of the possibility that the tribe would be put in a position to potentially pass on a settlement act and compact that didn't have a solid information foundation, which turned out to be the case. March 19th, people voted for something that didn't have any heart or guts to it. A lot of promises, a lot of statements that were general or statements that were, in some cases, misleading, statements that detracted from some of the main concerns, legitimate concerns that were being expressed. But nonetheless, the train was moving, and you had to either get on or get out of the way. And that's what situation we're at right now. Things can still be, if the state of Montana wants to play fair in this situation, things can be done well. Right now, we're in a situation where the compact terms provide that within 6 months after the last of the three parties, that's state, federal, and tribal, the last of the three passes approval of the compact, and that was, of course, the tribe. Within 6 months, then the proposed decree would be submitted before the state water court in Bozeman. We've been informed on the record by the executive branch legal office that that's not realistic, which is to say that it's not going to happen. So we're looking at a time frame beyond 6 months. And according to Montana state law, Montana Code Annotated 85-2-234, for anybody out there taking notes, there's got to be quite a bit of specificity in any final decree that comes from the state water court when it comes to identifying and articulating what an allottee's water right is going to entail. You've got to have, with specificity, the quantification. You've got to have the point of diversion. You've got to have identification of the land that the water right is pertinent to. You've got to have a purpose of use or type of use. You've got to have the owner. You've got to have the source. All of that is what it was supposed to have been in the Appendix 1. Again, finalized within a year after the state legislature approved the compact back in 1999. And again, we don't have it here in 2011. It's astounding. I would not be surprised at all if there's a future commentary in the form of a law review article or something similar, perhaps even a book that details this process and the federal government's dropping the ball as trustee. But again, if the state of Montana wants to play fair, if the federal government steps up to its trust responsibility, and if the Crow Tribe really starts to fight for the allottees, which it should have been doing all along, and part of that is making sure that the allottees are part of the discussion, that their input is considered, that their input is not only considered, but that it is responded to diligently, and so that every point of dissent is addressed properly. And that's the main source of criticism that I have, is that you basically had a tribe that wanted a tribal administration rather that wanted passage almost at any cost, and it was basically the executive branch asking for a rubber stamp from the Crow people. And whether that's what they got in the end, who knows? We'd have to go around to every individual Crow to ask them what their understanding is of the Settlement Act and the compact terms. But one thing, I don't know if we wanted to go in the direction of talking about the money. I mean, a lot of people voted yes on the thought that we would have large per capitas or a big influx of money or something along those lines, which is not true. Of course, the settlement Act appropriations are not going to be going to per capita. That's explicit in the Crow Water Rights Settlement Act. As early as 1990, the Bush senior administration established criteria, and that came from the Interior Department, for future Indian water rights settlement. The criteria was in response to President Bush signing into law a water rights settlement that was for the Puyallup tribe, and President Bush must have been fairly irritated that he had to sign a water rights settlement that had a federal appropriation with it, all the while knowing that the federal government hadn't yet established official criteria or standards to deal with the negotiations and finalization and presentation to Congress. And you've got over 500 tribes sitting out there with the need to have water settlement acts eventually. So in wake of that, President Bush articulated his intent through a signing statement of the Puyallup water rights settlement. So that was the source of the Interior Department rule. The reason I mention that is that the Interior Department rule included language that basically said that it would be strongly discouraged that any tribe receive per capita payments from any trust funds established by an Indian Water Rights Settlement Act.
Before we get too far involved in the economics, I'd like to drop back just for a second and address the allocation seniority question in reference to allottees and non-Indians that have now procured the allotment lands and hold title, and some clarification on that. If you could address that, because what I've seen is that in some papers it sort of points out that allottees are now receiving junior water rights rather than going back to the 1860s, the older treaties.
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know if that's widely understood either. And it does go back to the pie analogy, but I guess the best way to describe it, and it is a fairly complex area, just because of the fact that so much of the definition of what the state-based users will eventually end up with and what the tribal water users will eventually end up with in terms of quantification as well as seniority, that those are all large question marks. We don't know. But the compact, of course, anticipates and programs, really, there being a class of state-based water users, which is essentially anybody that had, under the state doctrine of prior appropriation, secured a state water use up until the time the state legislature approved the water compact, June 22nd, 1999. The phrase that's often used is pre-99 state-based water user. That category of water uses is Appendix 3 to the compact. I personally requested a copy of that Appendix 3 from the Montana Attorney General's office, and did receive it. I believe there's approximately 8,000 claims in Appendix 3, some of which are quite extraordinary. Earl Holdings has claimed the entire Little Bighorn River in a single swipe. I don't know whether that's going to stand the rigor of the objection that's eventually going to be presented before the Montana Water Court. But the key issue here now, those state-based water claims are going to be able to exercise seniority as to or relative to tribal new water development, and they will be on the same level of seniority as to tribal previous water development, and that is the tribal seniors, so-called, and they are in the same class with the state-based water users when it comes to a water short year, when you have the shortage sharing agreement language in the compact become relevant. And that's, again, pre-June 22nd, 1999. So think of June 22nd, 1999 as something of a watershed date and time where anybody that was using tribal water at that point and anybody that was using state water at that point are going to be locked in as seniors as to anybody developing water post that time. Now, the state has agreed to a moratorium on the issuance of water permits that are going forward from June 22nd, 1999 into the future, save for two exceptions, and that's the groundwater wells. I believe it's 30 gallons per minute or less, or the stock reservoirs where the source is not a perennial flowing stream and the total surface is of water is less than 10 acre feet per year. Now, outside of that, the state doesn't issue any more water use permits. The state can still approve transfers of water uses between water users, but they're basically locked in more or less on the big water uses as of June 22nd, 1999, going back in time, and that's the roughly 8,000 state-based water claims, which I understand every single one of those has been objected to by both the federal government as well as the Crow Tribe. Now, as far as the tribal seniors go, everyone wants to be a tribal senior, right? Well, that's the Appendix 1. Appendix 1 is supposed to identify with specificity all of the what I might call pre-existing tribal water uses, those tribal water uses that would have seniority as to new tribal water uses, that means post-99 tribal water uses, and that would be on the same level of seniority with the pre-99 state-based water users, and that's irrespective of the state water user's priority date. So that's a protection for the unfortunate state-based water user who might have a priority date of 1972, for example. He's going to be a junior. And another thing to note, too, is that the state-based water users, as to each other, can still enforce seniority so that you might have somebody with a much older state-based water right being able to substantiate a senior water call on a junior state-based water user. Now, insofar as the tribal seniors go, that's an undefined list. It will be soon defined, or at least we'll see the cards finally as far as what the hand the federal government and tribe have in this situation when it's presented to the state water court. The state water court is going to issue a